It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're hearing the official song of the Soccer World Cup, We Are One, by Pitbull, featuring Jennifer Lopez and a cast of thousands. The big games start tomorrow with a match between host country Brazil and Croatia, and there have been massive protests around Brazil in the run-up to the event.
Our next guest has followed soccer since before it was cool here in the United States. In a new book, he looks at the sport's global appeal, its rise here in the country, and the dark side that often accompanies it around the world.
George Vesey is a longtime sports columnist for the New York Times. His new book is 8 World Cups, My Journey Through the Beauty and Dark Side of Soccer. George, welcome to the show.
Hey, nice to be on with you.
Well, you were an early adopter of soccer by U.S. terms. Tell us about your team in high school in, I think it was the 1950s.
The 1950s, hard to imagine. Well, the team was okay. I was terrible. And I was on a team with many different ethnic players from all different nationalities. So we all had different styles, different languages, different outlook on the game. And I did get to watch from behind because I was a defender. I would see all these guys out there playing different styles, and then the opposition would come and run right around me and score goals. So that's all I knew about soccer until I went out to 1966 and saw the documentary of the 1966 World Cup. It came out a little bit later, and it was just such a great thing to see West Germany playing England in the finals, and I was hooked on the concept of the World Cup. I didn't know anything about the World Cup until after 66, but then I got hooked on it.
That's what got you into the game as a spectator and ultimately as a journalist.
Really, it's one of the great documentaries. It's not easily found in the United States. It's called Goal, and it was written by Brian Glanville, great writer, still with us in living in London. I talked to him recently, and he did such a good job of making it sound like the 1960s in a sports venue. There was lots of nice, cool jazz and very tight scripts and short skirts on the women and these mysterious teams, very Bondish, coming in off the planes. And he was right on top of the soccer end of it, but also the feeling for these different countries. And he never made it sound like a replay of World War II. I mean, when West Germany plays England in the finals, you don't have the sense that this is, this is life or death. This is, as he says, it's a football match.
Well, football, or soccer as we call it here, has gotten a lot bigger in the U.S. since you played in high school. Why were we Americans reluctant to embrace the sport for so long, and then what's turned that around?
You know, I'm not an evangelist for the sport, and I don't say, well, people should have discovered it, they should have done this or that, because we have so many great sports in this country. I mean, make a list of them. So for it to take a while, because we had the baseballs and the basketballs, and obviously American football, you had teams, fans waiting, but didn't know they were waiting for it. Then the world caught up with the United States by coming in not through the writings of reporters, not through common sense or good taste or anything like that, but just the fact that people began turning on the cable television and the internet and became aware of things like the Premier League and Champions League. And then the United States started to get a little bit better in soccer, and fans could have something certainly worth rooting for.
Outside the U.S., why is soccer the world's sport?
It's a very simple sport. My friend Paul Gardner, the British transplant who really popularized, I mean, I was way behind Paul. He was here in the 50s writing about it nearly, and he called it the simple game. And it really is, because all you need, I mean, the game started in England, according to myth. It started with people raiding graveyards and taking heads and kicking them around on some saint's night or other. But whether that's true or not, it didn't take much imagination to kick something round, and or even a sock or a can, and it was the easiest game to play. Then finally they got around to having real balls and shoes. King Henry VIII is supposed to have been the first person to wear cleated shoes for traction in other things that he was doing. But it is the game that grew in England. England exported it through its sailors and its merchant marines and people going to South America in particular. It's one of the reasons why in places like Argentina, half the major teams in Argentina have very English names. Newell's Old Boys or Racing or Arsenal or names like that. So there is a great English tradition. They're very proud of the fact that they exported the sport. It happened to go to South America and take root. And then in the colonies, we resisted it.
maybe this isn't unique to soccer, but in my own experience, I've gotten more interested in it, especially as my kids have taken it up. But at first glance, it's kind of hard to follow. It doesn't seem that exciting. There's not a lot of scoring. Does it take a little bit of soccer literacy to be able to appreciate the game as a fan, as a spectator?
No, I don't like to turn it into a kind of a, gee, if only somebody could think it through and see the true inner wisdom.
You're not an evangelist, I know.
No, but even at that, it's not something that I think, what was it, Louis Armstrong was said about jazz, if you got to explain it, you ain't got it. And if it wasn't Louis Armstrong, it was another, you know, somebody who came up the Mississippi. But it's a wonderful theory, and I don't want to be in a position of explaining soccer except this, that these are great athletes, the ones at the top level, and while it's low scoring and you can't use your hands, that's the old American cliche by old, now dinosaur sports writers, my generation, who would go around bleeding, but you got to use your hands. Americans will never go for a sport where you don't use your hands. So that's a dead theory. To watch guys at full speed, I know in 1982, I already liked the sport. I talked my way into a trip to Barcelona, not hard duty, you'd have to say. And I was there. They had two groups. One of the three groups had Brazil, Italy, and Argentina in it, in some funky little stadium where you could actually see the players. And I was watching. I had a very good seat, like the 10th row. And I was seeing players like Socrates of Brazil and Paolo Rossi of Italy and Maradona of Argentina, and they're moving the ball around, flicking the ball with the outside of the foot, the back of their foot, the instep with their knees, their heads. The ball was moving in different directions, and it was accurate, 10, 15, 20-yard passes through traffic, hitting somebody at full speed. So to me, I expected to like it. I already did like it, but the play was so good that I couldn't follow it. I had trouble remembering who had touched it, what they had done. They were so good, and that's part of it. It's not that it's so intricate, but that it really is a different sport from what we're used to seeing.
You mentioned Maradona, and a guest on our show just a week or so ago mentioned that he, Pelé, and now Lionel Messi, one of the all-time greats, all wore number 10. I think you've met all of them. Any thoughts on meeting these top-level elite soccer players?
Yeah, well, you know, meeting them is relative. I have been around Pelé some, and he's lights up the room. My alma mater, Hofstra University, had an academic symposium a couple of months ago, and there was the great Pelé coming in as an invited and I'm sure paid guest, and he just lights it up. People just like him. He looks terrific in his early 70s. So he's a star. Maradona was a little bit different. He's kind of a chunky, swarthy, obnoxious little guy. His fans love him, and a lot of other people don't love him, but certainly a genius. I saw him make a pass in 1990 in Turin, Italy, a grass skimmer through about 27 different Brazilian players, reaching the foot of his teammate, Caniggia, who scored an easy goal for the only goal in a very tight game between those old rivals. He was a genius. And then Messi today is a different player. He's a finisher. He's somebody, a little guy who breaks through traffic. He's at his best receiving the ball. And frankly, I think he's at his best receiving it when he plays for Barcelona and as people like Andres Iniesta of Spain putting the ball on his foot. So I really don't know how Argentina's always good. I don't know how good they're going to be in this tournament.
Well, it's the eve of soccer's World Cup in Brazil, and we're talking to New York Times sports columnist George Vesey. He's the author of 8 World Cups, My Journey Through the Beauty and Dark Side of Soccer.
And we want to hear from you. Will you be watching the game starting tomorrow? Who's your team, and are you or your kids taking part in soccer here in the United States? What do you make of the protests that have swept through Brazil in the run-up to the game? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. See if you can describe the beauty of soccer. You can also email talk@wpr.org.
We're talking about the World Cup and the international appeal and sometimes dark side of soccer. His new book is 8 World Cups. You can join the conversation. 800-642-1234. Are you going to be watching the World Cup? Are you pulling for a particular team, U.S. or otherwise? Do you play? 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. George, before we get to our callers, I want to get to the dark side of the equation. And we're seeing protests in Brazil leading up to the World Cup, people displaced from their homes in some cases for construction related to the event. Is this a typical story for host countries in a World Cup match?
No, it is not, and it's a good question. Of the eight World Cups I covered, there was never protesting like this. There were always issues. People are talking about things before when you go in there. But I've never seen the protests that have already taken place in the last year in a country that loves football, loves its patrimony, that talks about futebol. They have been having protests identifying the sport, identifying FIFA, the world soccer body, and the guy who heads it, a fellow named Sepp Blatter. They've identified them as the problem. And for Brazil, not that Brazil is a simplistic place. They've got a lot of smart people. It's a complicated country. But people have identified FIFA as the reason why their bus fares are going up. They certainly know that they've had to pay for the stadiums that are being built, for the roads, for the transportation going through, and they are not happy about it. And through the use of social media, and I don't have to tell readers of listeners to your station what the social media mean, you know, Tahrir Square and Taksim Square, and now you've got essentially Brazil Square, people talking about the indignity of having to pay for somebody else's party, even if they will ultimately watch the games, root for Brazil, be happy when Brazil wins, but they're making the point that they don't like being rented out. So the dark side really is organizations like FIFA, the International Olympic Committee, coming in and making demands for high intensity, high value stadiums and other things. You know that FIFA has become the joke in Brazil. People make jokes about, since they're having to pay for FIFA-level stadiums, FIFA-standard stadiums, they now want FIFA-standard transportation and FIFA-standard medical care. So FIFA, for the first time ever, has become an active, raging joke in the country where it's gone to make its money. And I would say this way, FIFA has been found out.
And FIFA and scandal often appear in headlines together. Is there something fundamentally wrong, opaque, mismanaged about the organization?
Opaque is exactly the word. It's the most opaque sports organization I know, and we've got a few in this country. We've got, well, the IOC is important here, but the NCAA, the National Football Concussion League, with not paying any attention to the damage that it was inflicting on players for dozens of years. But beyond that, they are more responsible to the general public than FIFA. FIFA answers to nobody except a very small group of people who run it. Most of them have been kicked out in the last few years. And that leads to the subtitle of my book. It's called, the subtitle, The Dark Side of Soccer. And I wasn't planning to do that much of a take it on the dark side of it. I was going to mention it, how Blatter was something of a character and he said dopey things and you couldn't quite make sense of what he was doing. But in the last few years, a number of officials in FIFA have been thrown out, have resigned or quit under pressure, whatever the reason was, for financial improprieties. It goes up to Blatter's door, doesn't get inside. It's one of those scandals where you wonder how all these terrible things, bribe giving, bribe taking, could have gone on without Blatter having a clue. Of course, we don't have to look very far in our own domestic politics for many, many examples like that, where you kind of cement yourself off from the reality. But Blatter has been tarnished terribly in this, and yet he's threatening to run for office again at the age of 78.
I want to get to our callers, whether they want to talk of the beauty or the dark side of soccer. We'll go with Willem and Colfax first. Willem, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm going to be rooting for the Netherlands in the World Cup, and the first game in their group on Friday is against Spain, that will be a repeat of the last title game of the World Cup, Spain versus the Netherlands, and they're both very good teams. Spain is incredible, their precision, their passing, everything. And that's another thing that's interesting about soccer is that there's so many different styles. The Germans are very tactical, precise. You know, the English, they're long passes. They're sort of more open approach. So a lot of different countries have a lot of different styles, and it's interesting to watch that. It's interesting to watch it because there's no breaks. You know, there's no huddles. It's continuous action. And then you can kind of see them trying different things to pierce the defense. And then you can almost see it coming when there's a goal, like, oh, they're going to make it this time or whatever. And so it's and to me, it is a beautiful game, and I love watching it.
Willem, thanks so much for that call. And, yes, there are times where you can just see, you know, the whole world standing up from their seat saying, is this going to be the moment? Your thoughts, George, on what Willem had to say.
Well, that's a terrific comment. That is happening in the years that I've been following soccer. I've gotten a little bit better at picking up on the trends of a match. And now in recent years, I've been able to watch, and exactly as the gentleman says, that I can see something change, that there'll be a difference. Instead of the ball being down on one end, it'll start to move up, or there'll be open space, or a team. And you know, they're very smart athletes, of course. They're trying to exploit these areas, and suddenly they find a way to get it over into that area, to put an extra man in there, to run a pass off it. And you do get the feeling of the tide changing, and you sort of anticipate a goal. I'm not surprised. The other day, the United States was playing a friendly against Nigeria, and you could just sense that Nigeria, A, wasn't really into it and wasn't playing very good defense. And the U.S. began to surge and scored two goals.
Willem, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Fulvio in Milwaukee. Fulvio, hi.
Hi. Yes, I wanted to step into this conversation because I have a little bit of identity crisis in this coming game because I'm originally from Italy.
Classic for soccer fans.
I'm originally from Italy, and you know, I grew up with soccer being a very big thing. And as a child, I just you know, kicked the ball wherever we could. If it was not a ball, it would be a tin can, but. It was culturally is a very strong thing. Then I moved in the States about 30 years ago, and so I became, you know, an American. And within these 30 years, I actually was married to a Brazilian woman. So at this point, you know, in the coming games, I really don't know where my team is anymore.
Fulvio, thanks so much. And George, you were saying this is that identity crisis is common.
I love that. Fulvio, I knew from when I heard your first name, I was sensing that you were going to say you were Italian, because in fact there was an Italian player a couple of decades ago, Colavatti, I believe, and he was a World Cup level player. But I know the name. If it's true that people can root for different teams, I call myself in the book, I do a whole riff on how I went into the World Cup in 82. Of course, the U.S. wasn't good enough to qualify, and I was sure that Brazil was going to win. But along comes Paolo Rossi and the Catenaccio and the Contropiede, and they wound up winning the entire World Cup. And that made me an Italian fan. I heard that beautiful anthem, the little tarantella, four different times, and I became a kind of a wannabe Italian. So I have this kind of opposite reaction now. I'm a loyal American, born and bred here, but I love when the anthem is played. It just makes me happy. I think of those Azzurri shirts. I think of Baggio, and I think of Toto Scalacci and all that. So it's very possible. I call myself, or any soccer fan can be, a soccer bigamist, that you have engagement. You have love of different teams. I think it's okay, Fulvio. I don't want to sound like you know, Dr. Ruth or, you know, some love counselor, but it's really okay.
Fulvio, good luck to all your teams. Go to Chris in Sheboygan. Chris, just a few moments left. What did you want to bring up?
I've been to three World Cups, Korea, Germany, and South Africa. I got to tell you, it's the greatest experience ever. You get to enjoy your time with fans from all around the world, all different colors and sizes and shapes and different styles of football. I'm actually on my way right now to coach a U13 club team, and soccer is all in our family, so we're spending a lot of time during this period cheering on the Americans and hoping they get a little further than that first group of death, and we're really excited to have the World Cup coming on television.
Chris, thanks for the call. Good luck to your club team. George, he's hopeful for the U.S. team. Are you?
Not really. I think they're in the group of death. They're in a tough group. They have been playing well, and they have their own little controversy of Klinsmann leaving Landon Donovan off the team. Klinsmann is a smart guy. I respect his intelligence. I respect his personality. I don't think he's doing anything to be mean, but he doesn't think that Donovan would be the right guy to have on the club. I think he's wrong, but he's not a fool. So we'll see. It's not the only problem the U.S. has. They have a back line. They've got to beat Ghana in the first match. Then they have to get a point here and there against Portugal, against Germany. It's a very tough task.
We'll leave it there for now. George, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, and thanks for the great questions.
That was George Vesey, sports columnist for the New York Times. His new book is 8 World Cups, My Journey Through the Beauty and Dark Side of Soccer.